Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for April's Neurology Club webinar. I'm very pleased to welcome our speaker for today, European and RCVS specialist in veterinary neurology, Luca Motta. Thank you, Luca. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. So today we're going to have a chat about the most common neurological disease in the brachycephalic dogs. We're not going to speak about all of them because we will take much more than an hour. Would like to tell you, well, you know, what kind of breed I tend to see that are affected by these neurological disorders. Well, we got the Boxer, we got the French Bulldog, we got the Pug, Boston Terrier Bulldog, Shih Tzu as well. And which disease do I commonly see? Well, we tend to see mostly brain cancer, meningoencephalitis of unknown origin, definitely congenital vertebral malformation, hydrocephalus, yes, we tend to see that, and carry-like malformation, and syringomyelia, intervertebral disc disease, and subarachnoid diverticulum. We tend to see mostly, as I say, you know, brain neoplasm, meningoencephalitis of unknown origin, and subarachnoid diverticulum, if I have to be honest. And then sometimes, yeah, we see also congenital vertebral malformation and hydrocephalus and the other diseases. Well, we'll start with the brain neoplasm. Brain neoplasm in brachycephalic breeds, well, this is an MRI scan of a brain and then the skull as well and the muscles around the skull, and you see that there is a lesion here that is invading the brain and is damaging part of the brain also, you know, part of the meninges and the brain as well. So, brain neoplasm, they are typically seen in dogs that are more than 9 years old of age. Usually in brachycephalic breeds, we tend to see mostly intraaxial neoplasms. Most of the time they are gliomas. We tend to, you know, I think, you know, we tend to see also other intraaxial diseases, but most of the time we think that most of these dogs, they tend to be affected by gliomas. I say we think because we don't do, at least I don't do, you know, brain biopsies. So it is difficult to ascertain after having done an MRI scan whether your dog or our dogs are affected by gliomas or by other intraaxial diseases. But, usually, you know, the brachycephalic breed has been associated to have gliomas. Also, they can have other diseases. They can also have extraaxial cancer. And sometimes they may have metastatic brain disease. From a neurological sign point of view, what we tend to see in dogs with brain cancer are seizures, behavioral changes. Yes, this is one of the most common clinical signs. So your client will come and will tell you, well, my dog is definitely behaving differently, you know, circling around, his head pressing, his pacing, he's bumping into things, you know, so he's got some visual deficit. It's very wobbly. Sometimes, you know, they can fall over from side to side. And they can have also, you know, when you do a neurological examination, most of the time you tend to see this head press. Sometimes you can see head pressing. You can see the circling, you can see that they are bumping into your consultation room, and also that there are multiple cranial nerve deficits, and often there is also absent manus response. I'm just gonna show you really a video of a boxer, okay? And the boxer is affected by, you know, this kind of movement disorder, so some sort of movement disorder, but these were what I think there were some focal seizures, okay? And this is something that, you know, so your clients may come over and may tell you, well, you know what, he's just chewing constantly, he's hypersalivating, and, you can see that maybe, I don't know, this dog there may have been poisoned, for example. That would be one of the first thing that you can think about, or, you know, that it can have a brain disease, okay? And that is, this was a boxer with an intraaxial lesion, on the piriform and temporal lobe. And these was and he was showing this kind of not completely tonic-clonic seizures, but these what I suspect they were focal seizures. Okay, this movement showing really chewing movements and hypersalivation. How do we diagnose this disease? Well, usually, from your point of view, so from a GP point of view, really, most of the time, as I say, you see the elderly dogs with some progressing neurological deficits. But then, and you, yeah, you can do a neurologic examination. You find out that the dog is circling, is pacing around, and then you, at that point, you need to have some more investigation. So you need to have some advanced imaging. And so most of the time, we tend to do CT or MRI scans. I prefer MRI scan because it's got much better soft tissue details. And then some brain neoplasms have specific imaging characteristics, but the definitive diagnosis is by histopathology only. So just bear this in mind, okay? So when we say these boxes may be affected by suspected glioma or other intraaxial tumor, astrocytoma, oligodendroglioma, well, we are giving a you know some no, we are not giving definitely a definitive diagnosis. So we're giving just a presumptive diagnosis, definitive diagnosis only by histopathology. How do we treat the disease? So once we know that the dog has got an intraaxial disease and we think that is most likely to be a cancer, well, we tend to I tend to use steroids. That is one possibility. And 0.25 milligram, 2.5 milligrams per kilo twice daily. Or then if the dog is seizuring, you can use anticonvulsant drug. Now, there is one recent paper that's showing that you can use definitely a combination of steroids and Keppra. And Keppra works very well with the steroids because it gives not many side effects. I found that if I use, for example, phenobarbital and steroids, well, most of my dogs, they tend to have really severe side effects, and they're gonna eat a lot, they're gonna be very thirsty, they can be a bit wobbly, they can put on weight. Instead, when you use Keppra and steroids, I'm having less problems. The only issue with the Keppra is that it's expensive. But apart from that, I would always recommend on a dog that's seizuring, and we know that there is an intraaxial disease that is most likely to be a brain cancer. Keppra and steroids, I think, is a very good combination. Then, of course, you can also do surgical removal, debulking, radiation therapy, and then or surgery radiation therapy. I think surgery radiation therapy is the best solution if we want to explore, if we want to do brain surgery in dogs with brain cancer in general. Lomustine hydroxyurea, we don't use it. I don't think there is enough evidence that they're working well on this on intraaxial cancer. And so this is a picture of a dog with the head just before the radiation therapy. He had brain cancer here. You can see that it's very well circumscribed. And then this was after the radiation therapy. So really, it's pretty small, or maybe it's even gone. So I think that it was a pretty good outcome in this particular case. Well, prognosis. We have many papers recently. They came out really recently in 2017, mainly in 2018, in which they started looking at how what is the prognosis in dogs where you do a surgery, okay, for intracranial glioma, and either or you do some radiation therapy either alone or combined with some chemotherapy, and generally we found that for gliomas, in general, really prognosis is pretty poor. The surgical therapy, you've got mean survival time that is about 66, between 66 and 185 days. With palliative therapy, you got about 69 days. So it's not really a lot of days, really, of survival time, median survival time. Radiation therapy, you got about 6, 12 months. You can use, but there have been papers showing that if you use some chemotherapeutics, you can even mean survival time of about 7, 11 months. And this was one of the recent papers with radiation therapy and temozolomide temozolomide it was about 420 days, so that looks pretty promising, for example. As you see, really, we are about, apart from this paper here, we are about, only a few months survival. So it's not great. Prognostically, it's not great. If you want to read something about, this is a very nice, very well done systematic review of brain tumor therapy in dogs. And basically, the bottom line is that the available data did not support the use of lomustine, which is chemotherapeutic as an effective treatment, for brain cancer. But also, the study did not show a clear difference in outcome between radiation therapy and surgery. Okay, I think we are far away from understanding what's the best way to treat, our dogs with brain cancer, especially with the intraaxial brain tumors. And there are, I'm sure there are going to be many studies that will hopefully put some more light on, about the prognosis, and hopefully we can improve our, therapy, and our we can improve the outcomes. Really, we can have hopefully good outcomes in the future. Another disease that we tend to see, not very often, but definitely we tend to see in brachycephalic breeds, is congenital vertebral malformation. So many congenital malformations, though, they are incidental findings. So you would do an X-ray on a French bulldog, okay, that comes in your practice because he's wobbly, okay, so he's ataxic, he's paraparetic, so he's weak, and he's got some proprioceptive deficit. You do X-rays. Sometimes you find that there will be some wedge vertebra, or there will be some, some sort of kinking of the spine, some kyphosis of the spine. That most of the time they are incidental finding, and in order to understand whether they are definitely the cause of the neurological deficit, you really need some advanced imaging. What we tend to see mainly is the hemivertebra, wedge vertebra, that lead to scoliosis and kyphosis of the spine. Mainly is the thoracolumbar spine, or is the cranial thoracic spine. You can also sometimes see the spina bifida or dermoid sinuses. Signalement, usually there are these cute puppies that are affected, from a neurological science point of view, you see a progressive neurological dysfunction. Usually they're chronic, progressive disease. Sometimes you can have an acute onset. They are ataxic, they are weak, aparetic, they are kyphotic. They have definitely some proprioceptive deficit, okay? And the owner will tell you, my dog is scuffing the limbs on the floor very often. It's pretty wobbly. It's becoming, more and more wobbly on the hind legs. And sometimes you can also see that they can be urinary and fecal incontinent, okay? And most of the time, this is not painful condition, but sometimes it may be also, they may be uncomfortable. As I say, you can do radiographs, and that is a very good screening because you can say, oh, wow, that definitely we got a major kyphosis, okay, so I want to investigate further, and then you will need to have an MRI and CT. This is a CT reconstruction, really, of a dog with a pretty messy spine. You can see that it's kyphotic and scoliotic. So this here, there is a, wedge vertebra. You got some anomaly of the vertebral body, and the spine is definitely very badly malformed, and so the spinal cord as well gets compressed. How do we treat these diseases? Well, there is no real kind of protocol, okay, I have to say, generally, but you can have either medical approach or surgical approach. Medical approach is you can use anti-inflammatory drugs and hydrotherapy. Anti-inflammatory drugs, you choose either some low dose of steroids. However, giving low dose of steroids or non-steroidal in a very young dog is not great, but you can use it. And you can do some hydrotherapy that would improve, hopefully, the muscle tone, and sometimes they can also improve, I think, the coordination of these dogs. And most of the time, I tend to choose medical approach for clients that they cannot afford. to pay for a surgical branch, or for cases where really you have such a kyphosis, and sometimes you can have kyphosis scoliosis together, that it would be very difficult to stabilize. But in dogs that there are good surgical candidate, we tend to recommend surgical approach. Surgical approach, you can use different surgical approaches. Okay, you can stabilize the spinous processes, you can stabilize the vertebral body, you can do an intrathoracic approach. And this is what I do. I tend to do an intrathoracic approach. I don't tend to stabilize dorsally here. You can use some sort of stabilization here on the spinous processes, but I don't use it because I personally don't think it will hold a lot. But there are papers showing that that you can have a pretty good outcome in doing that. And what we tend to do, well, this by the way is an MRI scan of two different dogs with the, you see it's such a bad kyphosis of the spine, which is impressive, and the spinal cord, which is these a soft tissue here, it gets very badly compressed in there. So you arrive at a major point of compression that you have basically, 70-80% of compression there. And here as well, you got normal spinal cord, and then you have really no spinal cord, I have to say, and then spinal cord again. So in these particular cases, I have to be honest, I'm not sure that medical therapy, I'm not sure that will help a lot, okay? Because, well, I'm not sure that you're going to achieve a lot. At least in my experience, these dogs, they tend to progressively deteriorate if you don't do surgery. Intrathoracic approach that I tend to use, basically you go within the thorax, so you do an intrathoracic approach. You then these are, these here are the vertebrae. Well, then you need to peel off the pleura from the vertebrae. Okay, underneath there will be your lungs here, lungs, and then there is the heart with the big vessels. The aorta is just running somewhere there. Then what I do is I put some screws, okay, cortical screws. You choose whatever you want, really, and usually a 2.4 would be good if you can do that. And you put them in the vertebrae where you can put them. Some people, which I think is good, that you can put some a screw also within the wedge vertebra. And so you in this particular case, I could have put maybe five instead of four, but I decided to stop here and put in on only four because this wedge vertebra, I didn't know whether how much bone purchase I had there. Okay, these are the lungs here. And then you use the Casper retractor. This instrument here is the Casper retractor. So basically you put two pins in the adjacent vertebrae, okay, cranially and caudally to where you've put your screws. And then what you do, you distract, okay? So from this situation, you arrive to this situation. Okay, so I think I put another slide where you can see. Yeah, so you put your Casper retractor, then you distract the Casper retractor. You see how much you can really stretch the spine. Okay, so you can really give more, hopefully, more space to the spinal cord. Okay, and so you are, you got less kyphosis here. And then you put some PMMA, polymethyl methacrylate. Underneath to basically which is gonna it'll be embedded in the screws, okay? And so then you do some postoperative X-ray. So we from this case, for example, we arrive from a situation which the spinal cord was kinked in this way, okay, through a situation which is less, okay, you got less kyphosis, and hopefully you're gonna have less spinal cord compression. And this dog, for example, it went very well, very, very well. This dog did very well. And then here, this is a VD view, which you see the cortical screws. Of course, after you need to put a drainage, really, in the thoracic cavity. But yes, yeah, so you can do. So I tend to do this kind of technique here, which has been described already by an Italian colleague, Massimo Baroni. Prognosis. Well, really, there is not enough data. So all the papers, they're not. We don't have papers on 100 cases. Or so we really in general, we cannot give really percentage to our clients when they ask us what kind of percentage success got. I think in the cases they have done, usually these cases that they tend to get fine. In the cases where I didn't do surgery, in these cases they tend to get progressively worse. So my advice is that for cases where they can afford the surgery, I would say yes, I think do the surgery. Do it earlier than way that the dog is getting paralyzed. And surgical therapy, I think, and also from science, well, from some there is little evidence, but I think the evidence at the moment supports that surgical therapy may give a successful outcome. Medical therapy, I think, stabilize the neurological signs, but I'm not sure that it can really, at least in my experience, it doesn't really improve a lot the the neurological status of these dogs. Another very interesting disease that I tend to see a lot now. I have to say that we tend to see maybe 4 or 5 cases a month. Is this intradural arachnoid diverticulum? This basically is nothing else than an accumulation of cerebrospinal fluid and dilatation of focal area of the meninges. Okay, so this is an MRI scan. So you see the MRI scan. You see that here, at this point, really there is an accumulation of spinal fluid. And if you see here, this is the spinal cord over there. Okay, and this is the C, a sort of cystic, okay, lesion. Okay, which is the diverticulum. So yes, there is a dilation of this subarachnoid space. And that constricts and compresses the spinal cord and leads to sometimes, well, most of the time, some syringomyelia in the spinal cord. So if you see that, I'll just come back a second. If you see that the subarachnoid diverticulum is here, and then it gives some edema within the spinal cord, and that creates quite lots of problems. So these dogs, they're really badly affected by this disease. Well, you can have two types really of arachnoid diverticulum. You can have congenital arachnoid diverticulum and acquired arachnoid diverticulum. The congenital one, they arise from a developmental abnormality of the arachnoid architecture. Maybe there is a genetic cause. So basically what's happened is that these are the three meninges. So you got the pia, mother, okay, then you got the arachnoid mother, and then you got the dura mater. What's happened is that there is a development abnormality in the arachnoid architecture, and so sometimes you can have that there is focal dilation of this arachnoid mater, and this compresses the spinal cord, okay, and that gives, well, lots of problems to these dogs. Then you have the acquired arachnoid diverticulum, which is, well, we don't know why they happen. Maybe they can be secondary to intervertebral disc disease, protrusions mainly, spinal cord trauma, maybe inflammatory spinal cord diseases. And basically, what's happened is that they may occur because there is a secondary to scarring or inflammation or fibrin accumulation. Okay, this is something that tends to affect. Well, yeah, it tends to affect the also the Rottweiler, okay, but this is not a Brachycephalic valley breed. But anyway, just for you to know, yeah, it tends to affect the Rottweiler, but also tends to affect mainly Pug and French Bulldogs. We tend to see many Pugs and French Bulldog affected by this disease. And the clinical signs, well, is similar to what we've said before for the congenital, spinal cord, spinal malformation. So you got some chronic progressive neurological dysfunction. So the client will come and will say, well, yes, I think it's fine, but no, well, my dog is just getting quite wobbly, and he's scuffing the limbs on the floor, and he's weak, and usually gets progressively worse. It's not painful, that's very true. So when you do your neurologic examination, you palpate the spine of these dogs, they are not painful, they're still mad, they wag the tail, they run around. This, so that it doesn't seem to be a painful condition. You can have some paresis, definitely ataxia, which is usually spinal ataxia, and proprioceptive deficits. And yes, definitely this is something that we tend to encounter fairly often. So urinary incontinence, fecal incontinence, well, usually it's urinary incontinence, but you can also find dogs with fecal incontinence, okay, with this disease. Well, diagnosis, yeah, you need an MRI scan, or, you know, we also sometimes do myelo CT. You tend to do myelo CT, especially in cases where MRI has not been really diagnostic. And therapy. Now, therapy, once again, no protocol for the therapy. So, you know, I think is recommended to do surgery, but you can also use a medical management. So you can use anti-inflammatory medication. You can rest these dogs, which I'm, you know, you can do physiotherapy, but most of the time, these therapies are likely to lead to long-term successful outcomes. I think usually the disease progresses, and these dogs, they get quickly. We're talking about weeks in which they really get progressively worse. Some dogs, I have to say, they may stabilize, okay, but most of them, they progress. And so usually I tend to recommend surgery, of course, all the time, because I think jet is the most widely accepted means of addressing the problem. So you need to open up the diverticulum, you need to sometime free the spinal cord from the adherences around the subarachnoid space, and so you need to you will need to, I think, you know, surgery is definitely the best way to proceed in these cases. Well, you have different type of cysts. In my experience, I've encountered different type of cyst, really, you know, and so there are different surgical approaches. So as I showed you before, this was a pretty, you know, sort of really a proper type of cyst, the diverticulum, okay, you can see that on MRI scan, it's pretty nice to see. From a spinal surgery point of view, I think that this surgery must be done with a microscope, because you need to see what you're doing and you need to see well what you're doing, okay? So we do it with the surgical microscope. So this was the surgery for this subarachnoid diverticulum. And now you see on the screen, well, you see this is the dura mater, okay, which, you know, which is open now. I put some stay sutures. These are 6-0 PDS stay sutures to keep the dura open. Okay, and you need to open up quite nicely all the space that you are concerned of. Okay, so I don't tend to open up just a little space of this, or the dura. Okay, so I tend to open up quite a big part of the dura, and I'll try to get a bit ahead to see whether I can see something. Well, basically, what I do then, I tend to take, well, you know, the tissue that is kind of surrounding the cyst, okay, you sharply dissect this tissue, okay, and once you sharply dissect this tissue, you will see more spinal fluid coming out, because the part of the spinal fluid was entrapped in the cyst, okay, and so when you open it up, okay, when you open up the cyst, okay, the spinal fluid will come out, and what will happen is that you are going to remove the spinal fluid that was entrapped in the cyst, and you're going to restore a normal cerebrospinal fluid flow, okay, just going to show you, I think it's coming up, let's see, so you see that the spinal cord pulsates, okay, you see, now I'm taking the cystic structure, the spinal cord is underneath, okay, now that is the cystic structure, when I open it up, with this, you see there is spinal fluid coming out, look at that. And then I just don't finish straight like that. I open up all the cysts, and then you see the spinal cord is underneath, okay, and it's pumping, you know, it's pulsating, and now you have very nice spinal fluid coming out, very nice flow spinal fluid coming out, and then at that point you know what I do? I open up all the cysts all the way through. You need to be a bit careful when I do this kind of surgery on the suction, okay? The suction may really suck, If you're not careful, you may really get a big suction of the sparcle. So really be careful. And sometimes you need to, of course, you need to be very careful to the vessels. Okay, if you cut one of these vessels, well, it's pretty difficult to stop it. But you can stop it, but it's pretty difficult to stop it. Okay, so I open up everything, and now, so you can see now the spinal cord nicely. Okay, you can see, and this is it's been opened. The cyst has been opened. Now I pass with this little instrument around to see whether there are some adherences, and that's job done, basically. Okay, and at the end of the surgery, I always close the dura. Okay, so you close the dura with some PDS 6-0. Okay, and then so you have no spinal fluid leakage. The spinal cord is underneath. You have no. I hope. I don't know. I need to see whether that is going to happen. But hopefully, you're not going to have major adherences forming around here. Hopefully, and also, I don't like to keep the dura open because the spinal fluid will come out and may create, some cerebrospinal fluid accumulation. You can have arachnoiditis. So I tend to close the dura at the end of the surgery. Okay, this is done with a surgical microscope. Next is another type of cyst. Okay, so you have these kind of cystic structures here. Okay, this most frequently, seen in French bulldogs and pugs around the craniothoracic spine or thoracolumbar spine. You see, there are adherences. So it's not like a cyst as we have seen before, but there are like adherences. So it's like that. The meninges, okay, they really are stuck together. Okay, and so the aim of the surgery here is to really remove all the adherences. Okay, once you remove the adherences, hopefully the spinal fluid flow will be restored nicely, and you're gonna have less spinal cord damage. I'm gonna show you this video because that is a completely different situation. So you're faced with the dura, okay? You put here, for example, I open up quite a big space because I wanted to make sure that I could see the normal spinal cord and abnormal tissue. Now you see here, you don't have really cystic-like structure. You have all these adherences there. You see that? So these are subarachnoid adherences, okay? All attached on the spinal cord, attached to the dura. This is a tiny bit more delicate surgery because what you have to do, you don't really have to cut, one of the Now, the cyst, and then you open up the cyst and job done. Here, really, you have to be patient and try to remove with the microsurgical instrumentation, or very small, instrumentation. You have to remove these adherences here because these adherences, they are constricting the spinal cord. You see how the spinal cord here is pretty large, okay? And here is much smaller. This is because there is an abnormal spinal fluid flow, and so there is some swelling on the spinal cord on this side of the screen. So what I do usually, gently, as gentle as I can, go around strictures, basically these adherences, okay? And I'm going to remove by them by using a small instrumentation. You tend to use yes, very very small scissors. But really here, I think the microscope is essential because without a microscope, I'm really I would really struggle to see all these adherences and to cut them without damaging the spinal cord, without damaging the vessels, the spinal cord vessels. So you want really to make sure that what you're doing is correct and you're not damaging the spinal cord. So basically, the aim of the surgery, is to go ahead and remove as much as you can. So I'm just going to show you and the next video, which basically shows. That the spinal cord seems to be, a bit happier. Okay, you see all the adherences now, they've been removed nicely. Okay, well, not all of them, but most of them. Sometimes you have adherences that are going all around really the dura and the subarachnoid space, and sometimes they're difficult to be removed because in my experience they tend to be really adhering and attached to the vessels. And so when you really want to remove all of them, because you want to be very picky and try to remove all of them, sometimes you may damage some of the vessels. And as I say, there's a pretty difficult situation there because you have to try to, stop or make stopping the vessels at the spinal cord, which is not easy. It's not easy at all. So here, basically, you see, it's much more free now. Okay, it's much happier, spinal cord. Okay, this dog went. It was very, very ataxic and paraparetic, and after a few months, the owner sent me a video of the dog running around like a lunatic. So it was very, very nice. Sometimes you have very good outcome, I have to say, after this kind of surgery, especially if you don't damage the spinal cord, or if you don't, if you're careful. Sometimes you don't. Sometimes these dogs, they may get a bit better, but they don't come back to the as they were before. Okay, well, this is, we go to the next one. As usual, at the end of this kind of surgeries, always closing the dura. Okay, so here the dura is closed with 6-0 PDS, and there is no obvious spinal fluid leakage, and the spinal fluid hopefully is restored. Okay. Prognosis. Well, there is a some studies report successful short-term outcome in approximately 60 to 70% of dogs. Median follow-up was about 23 months. Okay. However, there was a recent study that showed that the long-term outcome, long-term, was graded as poor in about 87% of these pugs affected by thoracolumbar subarachnoid diverticula. Now, that is an awful lot. Okay, that is really a lot. Okay, so long term, what I always tend to say to my clients is that maybe long term, these dogs may not do, well. Okay, recurrence or clinical signs can be as high as 66%. Okay, now bear in mind that there are different surgical techniques. There are people, well, there have been some, scientific papers in which they as far as I can see, there was no closure of the dura. They decided not to close the dura. Some people, for example, they marsupialize the dura to the surrounding soft tissues. Some other people, they fenestrate, so they do a durectomy. So they cut basically the dura, and then they leave everything open. So there are different techniques, and I have to say that some of them, some of these dogs, they may do, as I say, pretty well, at least short term. Long term, it looks pretty scary that we have an 87% of these dogs. Well, this study was done in pugs that they were affected, that they had some poor long term outcome. And if you think about recurrence or clinical signs, 66%, that is an awful lot. That means that every six dogs, seven dogs that we operate, well, every 10 dogs that we operate, six or seven, they come back with the recurrence of clinical signs. So it's pretty high. Okay, so it looks a pretty nasty disease, and maybe it shows that we need to get maybe, different surgical techniques, maybe. The other disease that I would like to have a chat with you about is meningoencephalitis of unknown origin. That is an inflammatory disease of the brain, is of unknown origin. It seems pretty likely that this is immune mediated. Most of the times we have dogs that are affected, they are about 2.5 years old, about, so but it may vary between 6 months and 13 years. I think usually we tend to have young dogs, okay? 1.5 years old, 2.5 years old, something like that. Commonly is an acute onset, and the female that tend to be predisposed. Yes, most of the time we tend to see these dogs there, they got seizures. They tend to show other clinical signs of forebrain disease like circling. That's very true. They tend to be obtunded. They tend to be very depressed and obtunded. And sometimes they tend to have visual deficit, head pressing. And I have to say, in my experience, they are pretty sick pugs and French bulldogs, okay? Really subdued, and most of the time, yeah, they are obtunded, and they can have these. They can have. They can come for acute onset of seizures. How do we diagnose the disease? Well, basically, most of the time is the signalement, the history, and neurological deficit that tell you that there is a forebrain disease, or there is a brain disease. Sometimes it may affect not only one part of the brain, but it may be multifocal. You can also have not only for brain, clinical signs, you can have also signs affecting the brainstem, the thalamus. So you can have different, kind of neurological signs. Sometimes they come because they got, a central vestibular, disease. In order to better diagnose the disease, you need to have a CT or MRI. MRI, I think, is preferable. And then you need to take spinal fluid, which is not always possible, especially if you have some signs of raised intracranial pressures. But most of the time, you can take it, and it shows pleocytosis in the spinal fluid. Okay. This is an MRI scan of a dog with a pretty severe meningoencephalitis of unknown origin. You see here around the mesencephalon and the medulla, and actually part of the thalamus is basically there is this area here which is an hyper intense area. It's pretty bright, and that is a sign of inflammation. Well, it's a sign that basically you have an increased content in water, let's say, like that, in the brain, and that tells you that there is it's likely that there is an inflammation there. And this is a transverse section, and then here on the mesencephalon, there is this round shape area here, and that was a pretty extensive, really, disease here in this particular case. And also you can have often you have meningoencephalitis affecting, of course, part of the meninges and the encephalon, okay? So meningoencephalitis. And you tend to have this edema, this hyperintense signal around the white matter. And that is, if you have a one-year-old pug coming for some neurological deficits, and you do an MRI like that, I think you see these kind of lesions. Well, it's pretty likely that you have a pug with meningoencephalitis of unknown origin. Of course, you will need to test for Toxoplasma, Neospora, Canine Distemper virus. So you need to test also for other, disease that can give you meningoencephalitis. But my experience is that it would be pretty unlikely that you're going to find on a pug, on a French bulldog of 1.5, 2 years old, an infectious meningoencephalitis. How do I treat the disease? Well, once again, there is no real protocol, but I can tell you what I do. Definitely you need to use an immunosuppressive therapy. Some people, they use corticosteroids only. Steroids and cyclosporine A or cytosine arabinoside or azathioprine or mycophenolate, mofetil. So you can use different combinations. So using corticosteroid only or other, or a combination of corticosteroid plus something else. I personally tend to use steroids, 1 milligram per kilo twice daily, and I tend to add cyclosporine A, which is basically Atopica. It's pretty the only thing is that it's expensive. So when there are some, I think this is my preferred, really, way to treat this disease. But you can also use azathioprine, which is less expensive and is really good as well. Okay. I tend to use 1 milligram per kilo steroids twice daily, and then cyclosporine 5-6 milligrams per kilo twice daily. This from a paper by Adamo, published a few years ago, where the mean survival time was pretty good. I think it was around 900 days or something. These steroids that are continued and the atopic are continued for a long time. So I tend to use steroids 1 milligram per kilo twice daily for at least 30-45 days together with the atopica. Then I tend to decrease the dose of steroids and atopica to once daily. Okay, so 1 milligram per kilo, of steroids and 5 to 6 milligram per kilo of atopica once daily for about 2 months. Then I tend to see how the dog is doing. If the dog does well, I tend to decrease it even more. So try to do maybe, once every other day for another 2 months, 2.5 months, then see how the dog is doing. And then maybe once every second day. And then sometime eventually, you can stop it. I think is sometime I can stop. I've had dogs in which I could stop it. Most of the time, though, it's very difficult that you can stop completely disease because it's a rela usually tend to relapse in my experience. So a few months later, a few years later, sometimes I've had a dog about 2.5 years later, they can have the same neurological signs coming back again. You're gonna do an MRI scan, and you find out that actually this reactivation, well, there is basically another focus of meningoencephalitis, or the old focus has increased, and it's a problem because at that point you need to start again from this dose of steroids and Atopica. I tend to use it, and once again try start and continue. Generally, I have to say that there was this very, very nice paper published by Nicholas Granger and Peter Smith and Nick Jeffrey, in which they did basically a sort of a systematic review of about 457 published cases, and they found that you have different treatment modalities here. This was a very nice table, I think, and you have with different therapies. Okay, you have the median survival time. You have all the median survival time here. So, and you also the number of dogs in the paper. Now you can see that the number of dogs in our papers, they are not like 100, 200. We're talking about 10, 30 cases. But anyway, so the ones that I tend to use is this from Adamo, and is about median survival time was 130 days. I think it's working very well in my experience, but other people may use different, techniques and different therapies. Prognosis, the long-term prognosis is variable. It's between 1 day and 2,469 days. So speaking to clients about prognosis is very difficult. You can say, well, your dog may survive 1 day or, a few years. But there are three variables that are significantly associated with a poor outcome. It was another very nice paper, published by the guys at the Royal Veterinary College together with Luc Van Ham. From Ghent University. This was decreased mentation and presentation, presence of seizures, and increased percentage of neutrophil in the spinal fluid. Well, that were a triad that tells you that maybe there's going to be a poor outcome in the dog. And the last disease that we're going to talk about is hydrocephalus. I think it is a very interesting disease. I think it's a pretty cool disease to treat. This is an hydrocephalus is nothing else than an active distension of the ventricular system of the brain. Okay, now the ventricular system, you got lateral ventricles, you got third ventricles, and the fourth ventricle, and everything is connected together. Okay, so we tend to see, brachycephalic breed. Oh yes, of course. You tend to see many brachycephalic breed that are affected by this disease. And neurologically, once again, they tend to be obtunded, they tend to have behavioral abnormalities. Yes, this is true. Difficulty with training, okay? Some clients will come to you and say, my dog is daft. And you say, well, maybe it's not daft. It's got some difficulty with training. Maybe it's got something else. But, and some of them, they cannot see very well. Some of them they really can be completely blind, and then you can have the circling, pacing around. Sometimes they may seizure as well. So a variety of clinical signs. And most of the time, these dogs they are pretty obtunded, and they got circling, pacing, and some behavioral abnormalities. How do we diagnose the disease? Well, you need to have, once again, MRI scan is the best way to diagnose it. Sometimes you may see, for example, on a clinical examination, you can see some dome-shaped head. You can see open fontanelles. You got Chihuahua coming that has got open fontanelle. You got, or you got, sometimes a French bulldog, a pug with massive. Well, the head actually is quite big. It's got open fontanelle. It's got, sometimes you can see also some ventrolateral strabismus, which is basically they're also called sunset eyes. Okay, so the eyes that displays ventrolaterally. And then, if you want to know whether your dogs definitely have, hydrocephalus, well, we do MRI scan or CT, or you can also do ultrasonography. MRI scan, I think, is very good modality. So you see, this is the big hydrocephalus here. This all the black stuff is spinal fluid, and these are the brain is this, okay, this left here, and this is the spinal fluid there. So pretty big amount of spinal fluid on the brain. Okay, and this was a CT scan of a dog with hydrocephalus. You see the brain left ear is basically something like that there, and some meninges. And that's it. Everything else is completely here in this section, at least, filled by spinal fluid. So you see, dogs, they don't need an awful lot of brain to live and survive. And this is all basically that your brain is there. Okay. Everything else is spinal fluid. Ultrasound. Yeah, you can use ultrasound scan. This is an ultrasound scan done by one of my colleagues from, Italy. Yes, it shows that this is basically definitely a large ventricles. They're all the ventricles, okay? This is all the ventricle, okay? And then you have, some tissue, okay? That is this one, okay? That is the brain. So you can also use that. And you can, but you need to be, I don't do that. You need to be pretty skilled to do this kind of ultrasound scan. But whoever has an interest in ultrasound scan of the head, maybe he can try to see whether he can see the anatomy of the brain and, whether there is an hydrocephalus. Now how do we treat this disease? Well, most of the time there is no, well, there is, I think mostly I tend to, if the clients can, I tend to treat it surgically. But there is no clear outline that describes when an animal should have the ventriculoperitoneal shunt, which is basically a shunt, okay, that connects the ventricle to the abdomen, or the dog should be treated medically. But usually surgical therapy is recommended, okay, especially when deteriorates after they've been treated medically, when it gets worse, when it shows, worsening of the clinical signs. This is, I think, is good to do surgical therapy. So really, we don't, in general, I think it's better to do surgical therapy if the owner can afford it, okay? Medical therapy, if the owner can afford it or he doesn't want to do surgery, what you can do, it may help to stabilize or improve the clinical signs in the short term, but it's often not successful on the long term. You can use different drugs. You can use acetazolamide, furosemide, omeprazole, glucocorticoid, mannitol. If anything, I tend to use steroids, okay, 0.25 milligram per kilo, 0.3 milligram per kilo twice daily. I don't think we got enough evidence to say that acetazolamide, furosemide, omeprazole, glucocorticoid, mannitol works anyway. So, but if there are no other ways that, or the owner cannot go ahead with the surgery, there is no other way to treat these cases, then you can use one of them. I think steroids are the best, at least in my experience. Surgery is done by means of putting a ventriculoperitoneal shunt. So you have a ventricular segment that goes in the ventricles. Then you got a valve, okay, which is a unidirectional valve. So basically shunts the fluid from the ventricle. It goes in the valve, and then it goes in the abdomen, okay. And the valve opens when the pressure in the ventricle is higher than what is in the valve, okay? You can use different pressure in the valve, low, medium, and high. Once again, there is not enough evidence to say which is the best, valve pressure to use. I tend to use medium pressure but for very young dogs with a very thin, cortical layer or cortex, brain cortex, I tend to use a low pressure, because I'm always worried that it can basically decompensate. They may, collapse. The brain may collapse. Okay. So here in this case, for example, you have a, pretty big amount of cerebrospinal fluid in the ventricle. Okay. And here you have this was a dog in which, look at that. There is a large amount of spinal fluid in the brain, and here really this was one of the ventricles, at least it was very big, and you have a major amount of accumulation of cerebrospinal fluid in the ventricle, and there was an active distension in the ventricle. Here there is also some brain edema, which is always telling me that there is some pressure within the ventricles, okay? So the spinal fluid is pressing a bit on the ventricle, so you have this inflammation or this edema basically of the brain. This tells me that these ventricles, they are actively distending. what we do is we do some preoperative imaging planning. You need to know where you go, basically, roughly where you go, of course. And then you, the most important thing is the depth of insertion, because you don't want to basically burst in one of these, you know, very delicate structures. So you want to know roughly how much you can, you know, put your ventricular shunt inside the brain. So usually I tend to use a pen to understand where I need to go and what, how, you know, how far can I put my ventricular portion of the catheter in the brain. And then you position the dog in this direction, because what you want is to have free access to the brain, okay, well, to the skull and the brain. Then you want to, then what you need to do, you need to shunt, well, you need to, yeah, basically, you know, tunnel your shunt underneath the skin until, you know, the belly, until, you know, the peritoneal cavity. So the first thing is to do a hole in the brain, well, in the skull, sorry, not in the brain. And, well, you're going to do the hole in the brain as well, because what you do then, you put basically the shunt within the, well, yes, you need to go through the brain, and then you put him inside the ventricles, okay? Then I always put the, you know, Chinese finger trap suture around the ventricular portion of the catheter, so that, you know, it doesn't really go, hopefully it's not going to be pulled out, okay? Then these are all non-absorbable sutures. Then you, this is the valve here, okay? You see, this is the valve, and you anchor the valve to the subcutaneous tissues, okay? And then the valve gets filled by cerebrospinal fluid. And if it's filled with cerebrospinal fluid, we are good. You know, we are in the we are in the ventricles, and good news. If it gets filled by blood, well, that means that maybe we'll burst one of the vessels. It's never happened to me, but I have to be honest. Hopefully, will never. But maybe that is just. But yes, if there is some clear cerebrospinal fluid coming out, we are good. And then you need to tunnel the, you know, the shunt underneath the skin of the dog, and you're going to put it in the abdomen. I'm going to show you a little video to tell you how we do it, because it's pretty, it looks, you know, it's pretty straightforward, basically. Okay, pretty straightforward. So that is where we need to go. So what I do is, basically, is you know, halfway from the, you know, halfway from the you know, the lumbar spine, basically, and the end of the abdomen, okay, just in the middle, there. Then what you do is, basically, you pass this passer, okay, and you tunnel the passer underneath the skin, okay. So, it's, you know, of course, we need to be pretty gentle there. We need to arrive until there, okay. Then we take a scalpel blade. And yeah, we cut without cutting our finger, hopefully. We just pass really the passer through. Okay. Then what's going to happen is that I remove basically this end of the passer there, okay. And then I attach the end of the catheter through a little to the passer. I think there is a little, sort of little stilet inside, really. Okay. And then the coolest part is that someone, which is my assistant, pulls out, you know, basically, you know, the passer, this plastic passer through this metal tube, and then you pass it through, and then you have part of the shunt coming out. Here we go. You need to be careful here that doesn't kink, okay? And then what you do at the end, you pull everything off, pretty automatic. Here we go. Job done. He's in the other part. And then basically, yeah, that's it. And then basically what you do, you put it inside, you know, the abdomen, okay? A little incision to put inside the abdomen. You put some finger, you know, Chinese finger trap there as well, so it doesn't really get out from the abdomen. and that job done basically. Okay, so everything has been fixed. Then I do. You can do X-rays later. You can see, you know, the your shunt passing there. You know the reservoir, the valve is there, and then the shunt pass through, and then you go in the abdomen. If you want to see better what you've done, you do a CT scan. So you this is a 3D reconstruction CT scan. You see all the shunt, the reservoir here, the valve, and then it goes in the abdomen. And the shunt basically is there now, okay? So inside the brain, inside the skull, inside the brain, yeah? So that is the shunt that is within the brain. And if everything works well, what you should have, you should come from a situation like that, which you have a massive hydrocephalus, to something like that, so a normal brain. Sometimes you have this kind of outcomes. This was 1 year after. And 1 year after, I had this kind of success. It was a very good successful case. You see, this is the valve here. And this is the brain as it was before. Very massive hydrocephalus. And this is the brain as it is now. So normal, basically. Okay? So that's pretty good successful outcome in this particular case. Prognosis, you have 33 to, I think it depends from papers to paper, but about 33 to 85% of dogs that die as a result of hydrocephalus-related complication, or maybe they are put to sleep because of lack of resolution of clinical signs. 22, 29% may develop postoperative complication like, you know, kinking of the shunt. You can have infection, inflammation. You can have skin necrosis. You can have different type of problem, or you know, you can have a disconnection of one or multiple part of the shunt. 8% of dogs may undergo shunt revision surgery. So if they dislodge, for example, you may need to do another surgery to put it back. Overall, you have 55 to 75% sustained improvement, and median survival time, we're talking about 320 days. Okay, so that is about what I tend to say to our clients. However, some dogs they really do very well, so 2,500 days, that's great. But about 300, 320 days, this is the mean survival time showing one study. 55 to 75% improvement, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. It's not great, but I think it's pretty good, especially in cases where I have to say either you do the surgery or the dog will just get worse anyway. So I think that if you can arrive to 55-70% improvement with you know another hopefully 2,500 days, well that's great. We've been very successful, and that's it really. This was the end of the talk. I hope you like this talk. One of the questions that I always have from my well from vets and from clients as well is how much does it cost to do these kind of surgeries? Well, for example, for the hydrocephalus, the shunt itself, I think is about £700. So we tend to do estimate. Well, for the surgery and things like that, I think usually clients they're looking about, you know, for uncomplicated surgery, which means that the dog is not going to be with us for a long time. There are no major complications. I have to say, most of these dogs, you put the shunt in after, you know, 1, 2 days, they go home because and sometimes they do very well. So I think it's about £4,000, something like that, for the surgery. And the surgery for the subarachnoid diverticulum as well, you know, is around £4,000 or £5,000, because that is tiny bit more, because usually these dogs, they made it, well, at least in my experience, they may deteriorate after surgery. If you think about, you're going to open up the dura, you're going to mess up a bit with the spinal cord, you need to remove some time adherency. So these dogs, they may come, you know, they may be okay, you know, they come in the clinic, that they're still walking, or they're even if they're very weak or wobbling, they're still walking. But sometimes they, after surgery, they may get paralyzed. Basically, they're not gonna walk. But after, in my experience, 3, 5 days, they tend to walk again, and then, you know, 10, 15 days, 1 month later, they're really good. You know, they got very, very good, you know, outcome in a large percentage of these cases. So I think this is. This is one of the most common questions that I tend to have from clients and to vets. And the other question, very, you know, common question is it worth it? So, you have a dog when you suspect, you have an hydrocephalus or you have, a subarachnoid diverticulum. Well, is it worth it to put in through the surgery? Is it worth it to, I really think so. I really think that it is worth it. And it's definitely, if someone asks me, well, for subarachnoid diverticulum, for congenital vertebral malformation, and for hydrocephalus, would you think that it's worth it to do a spinal surgery? I have to say yes. I think it's worth it because most of the dogs will get paralyzed anyway. Or if you do medical therapy, they don't tend to be fine at all. They tend to be puppies about 6, 12 months of age, and they need to have a good quality of life. So I think generally, for these diseases that I told you about, I think surgery is very, very appropriate. Yes, you may not have a good outcome. Yes, you may have, it may not be, successful. Some dogs that really don't do well at all, but I think it's worth to give to these dogs a possibility to get better. Yes. Okay, so I think that's all. Many thanks for listening. And if you have any questions or you want to discuss, something, that is absolutely fine. I work in Northwest Veterinary Specialist, so I'm more than happy to answer, any question that you have. Thank you very much, and goodbye.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Luca for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.